By nightfall, Art and his party were already 50 miles upriver. They were still in the settled part of Missouri, and when they made camp that night, they were within sight of a farmhouse.
After it's dark, me and Cavendish will go down there and get us some eggs.
Why would you wait till after dark, McDill?
What do you mean, why? Wouldn't you love to have some fresh hen's eggs with your breakfast come morning?
Oh yeah, that'd be good.
Me too. But I don't want to get shot in the ass by some farmer for stealing them.
I see. You were planning on stealing the eggs.
Of course I was planning on stealing them. You don't think he's gonna just give them to us, do you?
No, but he may sell us some.
Sell us some? You mean you want to buy eggs?
Yeah.
Well, this here will be my 7th trip up the river, and I ain't yet bought a hen's egg or a chicken.
Well, we're gonna buy them this time.
I reckon next thing you'll have us doing is saying our prayers and singing church hymns.
You know, a few prayers and hymns wouldn't hurt either one of you Cavendish, but you'll not be getting them from me. All right, I'm gonna go down and buy some eggs. Who wants them? I reckon a fip apiece will be enough to buy us a couple dozen.
A fip? You ain't getting no 5 cents from me.
Fine, then you ain't getting no eggs. Art collected from Montgomery, Matthews, and Hoffman.
I'd like some eggs.
Cavendish pulled a coin from his pocket.
Damn, Ben.
Well, 5 cents ain't that much, Percy. And I'd be damned if I'm gonna sit here in the morning watching everyone else eat eggs while I don't have one.
All right, I'll go along with it. But I'll be damned if I don't think this is about the dumbest thing I ever seen, paying good money for eggs when they're that easy to steal.
With the money collected from the others, plus his own, Art saddled his horse. Dog came over, ready to go with him. Dog, I'll be back soon. You stay here and watch my things. Dog stayed behind and watched Art go. Not until he was out of sight did Dog go over to where Art had made his own camp. Dog did a couple of circles of the bedroll, then lay down.
The way this fella's acting, he's probably gonna say we have to pay the engine for whatever beaver we trap.
My pa's a farmer. It's hard, honest work. I don't think he would appreciate someone stealing from his hen house. Besides, 5 cents isn't too much to pay.
I agree with Matthews. Buying eggs is better than getting shot for stealing them. What about you, Hoffman? Everyone else is putting in their 2 cents worth. What do you think?
I think Art is our leader. We signed on to obey. We should obey.
He's got all you buffaloed.
McDill looked over toward Art's bedroll and packs.
Wonder what he's brought with him.
McDill started over toward Art's packs.
What are you doing?
I'm gonna look through his packs, Matthews.
You got no right to do that.
You gonna stop me?
Matthews shook his head.
I didn't think so.
I don't have to stop you. He will.
Matthews pointed to Dog.
Ha! That dog's not gonna do anything. He knows me now, don't you, Dog?
McDill started toward Art's packs again. Dog stood up and watched him.
See, he's not gonna... Oh, shit!
You still want to mess with Art's things?
I wasn't gonna do nothing but see what all he was carrying.
I think maybe you should go back to your own bedroll now.
Come on, Percy. If that dog decides to go after you, he'll have your windpipe pulled out before we can even stop him.
What do you mean before we can even stop him? I ain't gonna try to stop him.
All right.
McDill pointed at Dog.
But me and you's gonna have an accountant one of these days, mutt.
When Art approached the farmhouse, he saw a tall, bearded man standing on the front porch. The man was dressed in homespun and holding a rifle.
Something I can do for you, mister?
I'd like to buy a couple dozen eggs if you got any for sale.
Did you say you wanted to buy eggs?
Yes, sir, I did. If they're not too dear, that is.
You a fur trapper, are you?
I am.
Uh-huh. I thought so. They've been coming through here right regular over the last few weeks. You're the first one asked to buy eggs, though. The others tried to steal them.
Tried?
There's one of them buried over there. I yelled at him to get out of here and leave my hens alone, but he turned and shot at me. So I shot back. It's a fearsome thing, killing one of God's own, but I didn't have no choice in the matter.
It doesn't sound like you did.
So, you're wanting to buy yourself a couple dozen eggs, are you?
Yes, sir, if you have any to sell.
I got them. With about 20 cents for 2 dozen eggs.
Art thought of the money he had collected. He didn't know how he would divide 10 cents up among 6 men. He could keep the money and no one would be the wiser, but he didn't want to do that. What about 3 dozen for 30 cents?
I reckon I can do that. Come around back with me. You can help me gather them. But you better stay close to me.
Stay close to you?
Over there.
When Art looked in the direction the farmer had indicated, he saw two dogs, both of them bigger than dog. Though they weren't growling, they were looking at him with dark, intense eyes.
If you had tried to come in here without me, them dogs would have been on you.
Yeah, they look mighty fierce.
They are fierce. That's why they ain't nobody got away with any of my eggs yet.
I can see that. I got a dog myself that's been following me around lately. He's come in handy a time or two.
Dogs is good things for a body to have.
The farmer gathered up the eggs, wrapped them in a cloth bundle, then held his hand out, palm up. Here you are, 30 cents. Art dropped the coins into the man's palm. The farmer wrapped his hand around the coins, then handed the eggs to Art. Carrying the 3 dozen eggs carefully in a cloth bundle, Art returned to the campsite.
3 dozen for 30 cents? You made a pretty good bargain.
Ha! I could have gotten them for nothing. You should have let me do it my way.
Yeah, McDill. Now that I think about it, I should have let you try. There were so many people gathered at the junction of the Platte and Missouri rivers that it resembled a small town. Tents and temporary shelters had been erected, some of which were made of logs, chinked with mud to take on a more permanent look. Several keel boats were tied up or pulled ashore, awaiting future employment. There were even a few squaws and children of some of the mountain men, thus giving the encampment even more of the look, feel, and sound of a nearly civilized city. The more substantial structures belonged to employees of the Eastern fur dealers. These men would buy the pelts here at a reduced price, then boat the pelts back downriver next spring. Until such time as there were furs to buy, though, they supplemented their income by providing liquor and goods from stores they had brought with them. Most of the goods the mountain men bought weren't paid for at the time of purchase, but were put on an account. The account was settled when the trappers brought in their winter's catch. The representative of the fur dealers would merely deduct from the pelt count, so that while a trapper might bring in 50 pelts, his indebtedness could cause him to be credited with only 25 or less. Art led his party into the encampment. Art looked back toward the ones who had come in with him. Get your horses unsaddled and take the load off your mules. We're going to be here for a while.
How long are we going to be here?
Oh, 2, maybe 3 days.
If I was leading this outfit, we wouldn't spend no more than a day here. I think we should get on up into the mountains, get us a head start on the others.
You want to go ahead on your own, McDill? You go ahead. I'm not keeping you. Art had already unsaddled and ground-staked his horse, and was now quickly and skillfully relieving his mules of their burden.
I didn't say nothing about going on by myself.
Art walked over to a fallen tree trunk where a couple of men were sitting. A small campfire blazed in front of the downed tree, and one of the men tossed a few cut-up branches into the fire. McDill and the others were still working with their loads. Dog went with Art.
Hello, Art.
The voice belonged to Jeb Law. Before Art went out on his own, Jeb had wintered in once with Art, Pierre, and Clyde. Hello, Jeb. Ed. Art nodded to the younger of the two. When Art sat, Dog settled down in front of him.
How'd you come by the wolf?
I didn't come by him. He come by me. He just sort of attached himself to me.
Gotta watch making pets of wolves. They don't ever get over there wild.
Well, I figure he's as much dog as he is wolf, and the dog part's pretty smart.
Say, where's old Clyde? Did he decide to stay back in St. Louis?
Clyde didn't make it. We was jumped by some Arickara. Clyde was killed.
Oh. Well, that's a damn shame. Clyde was a good man.
Jeb picked up a jug of whiskey from behind the log and offered it to Art. Art pulled the cork, hefted it to his shoulder, and took a couple of drinks.
Whoo! Whoa!
Where'd you come by that poison?
McGee's selling it. It's not too bad once you get used to it. I think he puts a little mule piss in it to add to the flavor.
Mule piss? Well, that explains its kick, then.
It's kick. Hey, that's a good one. You got your furs sold in St. Louis?
Yep, sold them to William Ashley.
I figured you'd go to him. Get a good price, did you?
I did.
Might think on doing that myself this year.
Well, it's not an easy journey.
No, I reckon not. What with it getting Clyde killed and all. Still, it might be worth it for the higher price.
Jeb nodded toward the men who had ridden in with Art.
So, what's with these men?
Well, I made a deal with Ashley to lead these fellows up to the head of the Missouri. I'll also be making peace with the Indian tribes.
Making peace with the Indians, huh? Well, I reckon if anybody should try and make peace, it's Ashley. It was his men getting them all riled up in the first place.
Yeah, it was a couple of men who were working for him, but it wasn't none of Ashley's doing.
A couple of men working for him, huh? Well, I'd like to get my hands on them, too. Let them know what I think of them.
Yeah? If you're serious about getting your hands on them, here they are. Art pointed to McDill and Cavendish.
What? You mean that's them?
Yep.
All I can say is they got some brass coming out here now, after all the trouble they caused. Was they part of the deal you made with Ashley?
Yeah. Art told Jeb and Ed of the arrangement he'd made with William Ashley, in which he would lead Ashley's trapping party up to the headwaters of the Missouri, and would also parley with the Indians in an attempt to make peace.
Why would you agree to such a thing?
Well, if we don't have peace with the Indians, we're going to wind up spending so much time looking back over our shoulders that we won't get any trapping done. I don't want to see any more of my friends get killed. Ashley agreed to outfit me, including livestock, if I would do it. So, here I am.
Well, I don't blame you none, I reckon. Sounds like a pretty good deal to me. Parlaying with the Indians might be a little harder than you think, though.
Why's that?
According to the squaws, a good number of the Arikara have gone to go live with the Mandan. And you know how Indians is. The enemies of their friends are also their enemies.
What about the other tribes? Ponca, Sioux?
Haven't heard anything from them. They might open their lodges to you. On the other hand, they may scalp you as soon as they see you. Look, you're up here now. If I was you, I'd just forget about the rest of the deal you made with Ashley and cut them boys loose to go on their own.
Mm-mm, can't do that.
Why not?
Because for one thing, I gave my word to Ashley, and I'm not going to go back on my word. And for another, if I cut them loose now, McDill and Cavendish will take over.
The ones who started all this trouble in the first place? Why would they take over?
That's just the way of it. I'd hate to turn them loose on Matthews, Montgomery, and Hoffman.
That's the other three?
Uh-huh. They are green as grass. Wouldn't take much for McDill and Cavendish to prod them into doing about anything they ordered.
Who's the big fella?
Oh, that's Herman Hoffman. He's a Hessian.
Looks like he could take care of himself pretty good.
I expect he can. Only trouble is, he's a man who believes in authority. If he figures that McDill or Cavendish are giving the orders, he'll follow them.
You don't plan to trap with those men, do you?
Hell no. As soon as I make peace with the Indians, I'll go out on my own. Thought I might head up toward Wind River.
Ought to be some good pickings up there this winter.
Looking around, Art saw several people running toward the center of the camp area.
Art, it's Percy McDill.
God damn, it didn't take him very long to get into trouble.
By the time Art reached the center of the commotion, he saw that the fight was already over. McDill was sprawled on his back, and the man he had been fighting with was standing over him.
You want any more?
No.
McDill had his hand on his chin, moving it back and forth as if testing to see if his jaw was broken.
I reckon that'll teach you to mess with my squaw.
The man shouldn't have turned his back. McDill leaped to his feet with his knife in his hand.
Doe!
The dog leaped up and clamped his jaws down on the wrist of McDill's knife hand.
Ah! Get away! Get away from me!
Dog! Dog let go. McDill stood there, rubbing his wrist.
What'd he do that for?
Because I told him to.
What the hell's all the commotion?
Realizing that he had lost his advantage now, not wanting to press the issue any further, McDill waved his hand in irritation.
Nothing. Nothing's going on. Just go on about your business.
Yeah, I'll do that. So long as you stay away from my squaw.
He won't be bothering your squaw anymore, I can promise you that. Come on, McDill. I think you better keep yourself out of trouble until we leave here.
I don't understand you, mister. I mean, we come out here together. I figured that should make us pards of a sort. And pards are supposed to look out for one another.
I was looking out for you, McDill. The fella you braced is one of the best-liked trappers out here. If I'd let you kill him, you'd be hanging from a tree limb by nightfall. A beautiful cabriolet carriage, pulled by a team of matching white horses, stopped on Chestnut Street in front of the House of Flowers. Dwayne Abernathy, well turned out in a gabardine suit with silver button vest, beaver hat, and white gloves, was a lone passenger in the magnificent carriage, as befitting his elevated station in St. Louis. Constable Billings, mounted, had ridden alongside the carriage, eating its dust. When they stopped, he looked over at Abernathy.
Are you sure you want to do this, Mr. Abernathy?
I'm sure. I've never been sure of anything in my life as a man of business. Before he left, Mr. Epson disclosed to me that the occupant of this house was in arrears on her payment. Serve the warrant, Constable. I want her and all of the Trollops who work with her out of the house by noon today.
Well, perhaps if you would give her an opportunity to pay off the loan in one payment.
Billings had pleaded with the banker before, when he had first learned of Miss Jenny's financial problem.
She cannot pay off the loan. I have reviewed her bank account. It is nearly depleted. In fact, she recently withdrew an amount of money exactly equal to what she owes my bank. One who was seriously trying to avoid arrears would have used that money to clear the debt. Do your duty, Constable. Serve the warrant.
Abernathy sat back in his comfortable carriage seat and pulled his hat more snugly onto his head.
Driver!
Constable Billings tied off his horse at one of the several wrought iron hitching posts in front of the fine white-painted house. Then went inside. Jenny met him in the foyer.
Constable!
Constable Billings removed his hat and rolled it in his hands for a moment before he spoke. He had never been in such an uncomfortable situation in his whole life.
Miss Jenny, I hate being the one to do this, but I've been asked to serve a warrant of eviction.
Eviction?
Yes, ma'am.
But I don't understand. How can I be evicted from my own house?
Well, ma'am, that's just it. This isn't your house anymore. According to the loan contract at the bank, it can be foreclosed at any time if a payment is late. And you are late.
But that's not true, Constable. I don't even have a loan at the bank anymore. I paid it off, in full.
You paid the loan off? When?
Why, back in July. I wrote a bank draft for the full amount to Mr. Epson.
Miss Jenny, would you come with me? Perhaps if we went to the bank, we could get to the bottom of this.
Yes, I would be glad to come with you.
Constable Billings, Dwayne Abernathy, and Logan McMurtry, the new chief of tellers, stood in the little fenced-off area that was the office of the chief of tellers. His mahogany desk was covered with correspondence, bank papers, and open ledger books. Several inkwells held inks of black, blue, and red.
As you can see, Constable Billings, her loan is still outstanding.
But how can that be? I have paid off the loan.
By bank draft, you say?
Yes, $475. I'm sure if you check the ledger, you will see where I issued an instrument of that precise amount.
Oh, I agree. You wrote a draft for $475, for here is the entry, made on July 23rd in the year of our Lord, 1824. But according to this entry, the funds were given directly to you. You'll see as much right here.
McMurtry hefted the ledger to show her.
What? No! No, they were to repay the loan.
Miss Jenny, do you have anything to prove that? A receipt, a letter, something to show that the loan was paid?
Jenny shook her head. She now regretted not asking Epson for a payment note and the title on the very morning she had paid him.
No, I don't. Mr. Epson said he would take care of it for me, and I assumed that he would. Perhaps it was delayed by his departure to Philadelphia?
You say you gave the money to Epson?
Yes.
Well, if you gave it to him, but there's no record of it, what do you think happened to the money?
I'm sure I don't know.
Actually, Jenny now had deep suspicions, and she was almost sick with fear and regret.
Oh, I'm sure you do know. You kept it for yourself.
No, I didn't. I can assure you I gave the money directly to Mr. Epson.
And yet, clearly, there is no entry to that fact, your assurances notwithstanding.
Oh, I wish there was some way that we could talk to Mr. Epson. He would be able to clear this up, I'm sure.
Jenny looked from McMurtry to Abernathy, but saw no sympathy in either man.
I did talk to Mr. Epson. Before he left, he informed me that if the bank received no more money from you by the next payment date, you would be in arrears.
Mr. Epson told you that?
He did.
But that's not true. He knows that's not true.
Why then would he tell me such a thing?
I hate to say this, But if he didn't apply the money to my loan, as I assumed he would, the only thing that could have happened is that he took it.
You are saying that Theodore Epson stole your money?
That's the only conclusion I can come to.
You know what I think, Constable? I think that when this woman learned that Mr. Epson had left our bank to take employment back east, she figured that would be the perfect opportunity to make such a spurious claim. She seeks to defraud the bank at the expense of the reputation of as fine a man as has ever graced our fair city. I wish there was more we could do to her besides confiscate the house. I wish we could throw her in jail for libel and slander and throw away the key.
But I'm telling the truth. I swear I'm telling the truth. I gave the money to Mr. Epson.
Do your duty, Constable. Evict this woman from my house.
I'm sorry, Miss Jenny. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you and your girls to leave the house.
But please, Mr. Abernathy, if you turn us all out, where will my girls go?
For the first time in a very long time, Jenny felt desperate. It reminded her of her days as a slave, when she had absolutely no control over her own destiny. The days before the mountain man had purchased her freedom and given her a chance at a new independent life.
Where you and your girls go is none of my concern. However, I would remind you that while St. Louis has no ordinance prohibiting a bawdy house, we do have a law against street solicitation for immoral purposes. And I intend to see that Constable Billings and his men uphold that law. So I wouldn't go out on the street if I were any of you.
I'm sorry, Miss Jenny.
I know this isn't your fault. You're just doing your duty.
Yes, ma'am. I'm glad you see it that way.
Theodore Epson sat across the desk from Joel Fontaine, the president of the Trust Bank of Philadelphia. They were in Fontaine's office, and as a measure of the size of the Trust Bank, Fontaine's office alone was as large as the entire riverbank of St. Louis.
I've never been to the teeming metropolis of St. Louis, but I would dearly like to visit there sometime. How did you find it during your time there, Epson?
I assure you, Mr. Fontaine, you would not like it. St. Louis is a dirty, lawless, and barely civilized town. Its streets are filled with trappers and fur dealers who are little more than wild savages. Prostitutes conduct their business without fear of the law, though I am pleased to say that I put into motion a means whereby the most notorious of all the brothels will, no doubt, be closed very soon.
Oh? And how did you do that?
I denied them access to their ill-gotten gains.
Good for you. I'm sure the city of St. Louis was sorry to see such an upstanding citizen as yourself leave its precincts.
No doubt. But I assure you, sir, that feeling was not reciprocated. I can't tell you how happy I was to get your offer, so I could leave that godforsaken place.
Fontaine looked down at a piece of paper that lay on his desk.
Yeah, and I see that you have just opened your own personal account for $900. That is an impressive amount of money, so you must have done well by yourself while you were in St. Louis.
Yes, I was quite frugal during my stay.
Epson pulled his heavily starched shirt collar away from his neck. He had kept the money given him in confidence by William Ashley, and he had executed the draft given him by Jenny, keeping that money as well. Even after the expense of moving from St. Louis to Philadelphia, he still had over $900 left. All in all, a profitable enterprise, albeit with other people's money. Some might consider what he did as dishonest, but Epson, well, that son of a bitch was convinced that he had performed a service for the city of St. Louis. It was clear that a majority of the citizens there wanted the whorehouse to be closed, and this would give them a way to eliminate it. He justified keeping the money from Jenny because it was obviously obtained as a result of her immoral and indecent operation. He also didn't feel guilty about keeping the money given him by William Ashley. The way he looked at it, everyone benefited from his action, except for the two people, the whore and her mysterious benefactor.
Well, sir, on behalf of the bank, welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you, sir. I'm very glad to be here. In fact, more than you'll ever know.
Jenny called her girls together. She informed them quietly that they were being forced out of the house.
But why, Miss Jenny?
What have we done to anyone? We have committed no offense. It's just that there are some people who are all proper on the outside, but just plain mean on the inside. I fear we've made enemies of such a person.
But how can they throw us out of the house? I thought you had paid the bank everything you owed them.
I have paid the bank what I owe them, Carla. But it would seem that Mr. Ebsen was not as honest as he appeared. He ran away with the money.
One by one, the girls came to Jenny, hugged her, and went back to their rooms to pack their few belongings. Jenny lingered in the foyer for a moment longer, allowing her hand to pass over the banister and looking at the crown molding around the room. She realized, with a pang of regret, how beautiful the house was and how much she was going to miss it. Slowly, as if by delaying each step she could stave off the inevitable, Jenny climbed the stairs to the second floor. She went into the bedroom. This was the same bedroom where for many years she had dreamed and fantasized about Art. Recently, as if a fantasy realized, Art had appeared out of nowhere. When she awakened the next morning, she saw that it wasn't a dream. He was still there. Now, after a glorious reunion, Art had gone back west, returning to the mountains. What if he came back looking for her? Without this house, he might not find her. Unable to control her tears, Jenny began packing her clothes. It was more than a loss of livelihood or even the loss of a roof over her head that made Jenny cry. The House of Flowers was the closest thing to a real home Jenny had ever had in her life. It had been her plan to make enough money to someday leave the prostitution business. Then the House of Flowers truly would have been a home. Perhaps even a home to which Art might someday come to live. Deep in her soul, she knew that it was very unlikely that Art would ever settle down in a city. But fantasies of such a future had occupied her thoughts for a long time. When Jenny came down to the foyer a while later, all five of her girls were gathered in the foyer with all their belongings, waiting for some direction from the woman who had taken care of them for so long.
What do we do now, Miss Jenny?
I wish I could tell you, Sue Ellen. I wish I knew what I was going to do.
I know what I would do if I were a man. If I were a man, I would leave St. Louis.
Leave St. Louis? And go where?
I don't know. West, maybe. Yes, I'd go west.
Miss Jenny, I got the carriage drawn up out front. You want me to put your luggage in?
Yes, Ben. I suppose so.
Jenny looked at the other girls and suddenly she smiled.
Wait, Carla, you would go west?
Uh-huh.
What a wonderful idea!
Jenny grabbed Carla and hugged her as she danced her around the foyer.
Miss Jenny, are you all right?
All right. Woo, I've never been more all right. Ben?
Yes, sir?
Do you think you can find someone who would trade us a good, sturdy wagon for the carriage?
Miss Jenny, I expect you could get two fine wagons for that carriage. That is one fine carriage.
Oh, even better. Get two wagons and four mules.
Mules, Miss Jenny?
Yes, mules.
Jenny looked again at her girls.
Sue Ellen, Cindy, Lisa, Millie, Carla, we are going west.
The engines of the Ponca tribe all went out to welcome Artur and his fellow travelers. The women made Injun fry bread and roasted game. The men performed dances, and Artur was invited to join them in the inner circle of the council fire. When McDill started to sit in the inner circle as well, without being invited, a couple of warriors stood in his way.
Art, tell these ignorant savages to stand aside and let me sit down.
You can sit anywhere you want, McDill, except in the front circle.
What do you mean I can't sit in the front circle? I'll sit any damn where I please.
Art, who was already seated, turned to look back toward McDill.
You can sit anywhere you want, except in the front circle.
You're sitting there.
I was invited.
Why wasn't I invited?
Maybe it's because you presumed to sit there before you were invited.
That makes no sense. If they were going to invite me anyway, why not just let me sit there now?
It's the Injun way.
Goddamn Indian savages.
McDill sat further back, joining the other trappers. Spotted Pony held his arms forward, spread shoulder-width apart, palms up. The shaman placed a lit ceremonial pipe into his hands, parallel with Spotted Pony's shoulders. Gingerly, Spotted Pony lifted the pipe above his head and mouthed a prayer. Bringing the pipe back down, he turned it very carefully, pushing the bowl forward with his right hand, bringing the mouthpiece back with his left. He took a puff on the pipe, then used his right hand to wave some of the escaping smoke back into his face. Afterward, he held the pipe out toward Art, inviting him to smoke as well. Art smoked the pipe with Spotted Pony, being very careful to follow the same prescribed ritual. Art then passed the pipe around to the others in the inner circle, and only after all had smoked did the conversation begin. Spotted Pony sat down next to Art.
You are the one called Artur?
Yep.
You have killed many Indians, Artur.
Yeah, I have killed many Indians, and I have killed white men. But I've only killed those who were trying to kill me. A very old and wrinkled man leaned over to say something to Spotted Pony. This was the shaman, the medicine man who'd lit the pipe and placed it so carefully in Spotted Pony's hands when the ritual began. Spotted Pony nodded as the other spoke.
He who sees says that your heart is pure and your words are true, Artur. You have killed only those who tried to kill you. You and another were riding on a big canoe on the water when Arikara attacked you. They killed the one with you, but they did not kill you.
Art nodded, wondering how the old man knew that.
They killed my friend, Clyde Barnes.
You killed many of them, but you have made an enemy of Wakthago.
I do not know Wakthago.
Wakthago is the warrior who killed your friend. You killed many of his warriors, and now, because the teepees of many were empty when he returned to the village, Wakthago is no longer welcome among the Arikara, his own people. He is not welcome by the Ponca, the Mandan, the Sioux, or the Crow. The heart of Wakthago is very hot and cannot be cooled. He wants only to kill you.
I hope to make peace with the Arikara, as I hope to make peace with the Ponca, Mandan, Sioux, Crow, and Blackfoot. I would even make peace with Wakthago if he would cool his heart.
You have brought gifts for the Ponca?
Art smiled, grateful that Mr. Ashley had provided for this moment.
Yep. Fur chief who lives in St. Louis has sent many good gifts to show his appreciation for allowing trappers to take beaver.
It is good that we should have peace.
From each village, an Indian messenger was sent ahead to the next, telling of the peace mission of the trapper known as Artur. Because the messengers were sent ahead, every village turned out to welcome Art, and soon he had negotiated peace treaties with nearly all the Indians along the Missouri. The Poncas, Sioux, Cheyennes, Hidatsas, Mandans, and even the Arikara. The Indians all acknowledged the rights of the trappers and fur traders to take beaver on their land, and Art promised fair treatment to the Indians on all future trades. No more will our people trade bad whiskey for good pelts. For his part, the Arikara chief, known as the Peacemaker, promised that the Arikara would make no more war. But he also warned that Wakthago, who had made his own personal war against Artur, had left the Arikara and now lived with the Blackfoot and called himself a Blackfoot.
I think Wakthago and the Blackfoot will not make peace with you.
I will try to make peace with them. I've lived with the Injun, and I consider the Injun to be my brother. I have no wish to kill my brothers.
At the mouth of the Yellowstone, Art sent word to the Blackfoot, Assiniboine, and Crow, inviting them to come talk peace. Only the Crow could be coaxed in, and their chiefs came to the meeting arrayed in their finest blankets and robes. The meeting, designed to discuss peace, nearly started a war. Art displayed the gifts he had intended to give the Indians in exchange for their promise not to make war on the white fur trappers. When one of the chiefs reached for the gifts before he was invited to do so, Gil clubbed him over the head with his pistol butt. Angry, the other chiefs threw off their robes and raised their war clubs. Horse and Art and the others to wade into the fray, swinging their muskets. Within a few moments, all five engines were on the ground, and it was obvious to Art that MacDill was about to kill one of them.
No, MacDill!
MacDill was on the ground with his knife at an engine chief's throat. The engine was staring up at him defiantly, unable to defend himself but unwilling to show fear. MacDill held the knife there for a long moment until Art pointed his rifle at MacDill.
I said no! Leave him be!
Whose side are you on? The man or the Redskin?
I'm on my side, and if you kill him, we'll have the entire Crow Nation on our backs.
MacDill made no effort to release the engine chief.
Let him up, now. If you don't, I'll kill you.
The other engines, who by now had regained their feet, looked on with wide eyes at the drama playing out between the white men. They had never seen such enmity between these fur trappers before.
You kill one of your own?
You aren't one of my own, MacDill.
MacDill then stood up and put his knife away.
Sure, Art. I was just funning with him anyway.
Warily, the chief regained his feet and looked over at Art.
Help yourself. The engine hesitated. Here.
Art picked up a fine bone-handled knife and handed it to the chief.
These are for you, for all of you.
Smiling, the engine held the knife out and looked at it. Art waved an inviting hand over the pile of gifts.
Wait, not all them gifts is for the Crow. We still got the Assiniboine and the Blackfoot to worry about.
That's a fact, but the time may come up here when we need some allies. And these engines may just be what we need, providing you don't try any more dumbass stunts like the one you just pulled.
When the Crow left the encampment an hour or so later, they were laden with every gift Art's little party had remaining. Now, if the trappers encountered the Blackfoot or any other hostile tribe up here, they might be able to count on the Crow for help. In fact, just before the Crow left, one of them, the one who had nearly been killed by MacDill, approached Art.
You would have killed your own to save me?
I would.
How are you called?
I'm called Artur.
I have heard of you, Artur. I am Redtail.
Redtail put his right hand on Art's left shoulder, and Art did the same to him.
And I have heard of you.
It is good that you would kill one of your own to save the life of a Crow. Because you would do that, we will throw out all that has passed behind us. The Crow will be the friend of Artur.
And you will not make war with the trappers and fur traders?
We will make no war.
Perched high on the end of a bluff that protruded over the water, stood a fort constructed of palisade logs. There were two projecting blockhouses on corners opposite each other from which the guards would not only have a view of the river approach and surrounding countryside, but could also cover, by rifle fire, the outside walls of the fort itself. The American flag fluttered from a wooden pole atop the nearest blockhouse. Although the structure had all the appearance of a U.S. Army fort, it was actually the trading post Ashley had told Art about. It had been established by the American Fur Company and was ably commanded by Joe Walker, the head of the trading garrison. The front gate to the fort was closed tight when Art and his entourage arrived. Art looked toward the blockhouse that had a view of the gate. It appeared to be empty.
Maybe there's nobody here.
Someone's here. Gate has to be closed from the inside.
It's not good military sense to leave a blockhouse empty.
A face appeared over the balustrade of the blockhouse.
Well, hell. Dog has the right idea. All we had to do is knock.
The man in the blockhouse pointed a rifle down toward him, more than a bit unsteadily.
Who are you and what do you want?
Name's Art. We got a letter from Joe Walker from Mr. William Ashley in St. Louis.
The man in the blockhouse stared at him for a long, silent moment. His face was all screwed up as if he'd been eating lemons.
For God's sake, man, do we look like Injuns to you?
Open the gate.
Just inside the gate, in the middle of the open area, which resembled a small parade ground, sat a cannon. A man came up to meet him. Joe Walker was only 2 inches over 5 feet tall and nearly as big around. He had a bald head and a full brown beard, and he scratched at his bushy whiskers as he read the letter Art presented to him.
How are things back in St. Louis?
Noisy.
Noisy indeed, yes. I would say the city is noisy, all right. I miss it, though. All the people, especially women. Not many women out here, except the Indian gals, who are nice but don't savvy the American language much.
Well, some people talk too much as it is.
You and your men must join me for dinner. I'm anxious to hear more about your trip.
Art's party actually cleaned themselves up a little before they sat down with Joe Walker in his quarters for a sumptuous meal.
How goes your peacemaking mission?
How'd you know of our mission?
Oh, word has come from the friendly tribes downriver.
Well, so far it's gone well. We've made peace with the Arikara, and they were on the warpath last year.
But you have not made peace with the Blackfoot.
No.
Nor will you. The Blackfoot are why we built this fort. Such savages are they that even their own kind will have little to do with them. However, I wish you luck in your effort. Were peace to be made with them, it would make our task much easier.
Well, we sure want to make your life easier.
The Hessian Hoffman shot MacDill a hard look.
What'd I say?
We are here to improve the business prospects of the American Fur Company. And we appreciate the efforts you gentlemen have exerted to ensure our success.
Glad to be of service.
After the meal, Art and Walker talked on long into the night about the goings-on in the territory, swapping information. Art was determined to know as much as he could about what lay ahead for him and his men. Wakdago got up with the sun and walked through the quiet village. The fire of last night's council had been reduced to a pile of white ash that gave off only a tiny amount of smoke. The Blackfoot were aware that Artur was making peace with all the other nations, and they held council to decide whether or not they would accept his peace offer. There were some who counseled peace. Chief among the peacemakers was a man named Running Elk, who was the oldest and wisest shaman of the village. Wakthago was very much against making peace, and though Wakthago was a recent emigre to the Blackfoot Nation, he had been totally accepted as one of them. This was in part because of his reputation as a fierce warrior, and in part because he was a member of the Bear Society, one of the most honored of the war societies. Wakthago proposed that, instead of making peace with Artur, they send out a war party to find him and kill him. Wakthago even offered himself as leader of the war party. The discussion was heated on each side of the issue, but by the end of the evening, no real decision had been made. As far as Wakthago was concerned, no decision was just as effective as a decision in favor of war. That was because it effectively kept the current policy in place. And the current policy of the Blackfoot was belligerence with the white trappers and hunters. Still thinking about the council of the night before, Wakthago left the teepees and smoldering campfires, then climbed to the top of the 100-foot promontory that jutted out over the Yellowstone River. From there, he could see the sun, now a glowing orange ball poised just over the distant horizon. As the sun rose higher in the sky, it began to spread pools of brilliantly shining gold and silver across the surface of the water. Then, when it became so bright that it started to hurt his eyes, Wakthago turned to look back at the village he had just left. Here and there were wisps of smoke curled up from holes in the tops of the teepees, evidence that the people of the village were just beginning to rise. Then, quite unexpectedly, the rising hackles on the back of Wakthago's neck told him that he was not alone. He spun around quickly and was shocked to see Running Elk behind him.
How did you get here? What are you doing here? If you have come to speak again of making peace with the white man, you may as well shout your words into the wind, for my ears are closed.
Running Elk remained silent.
Why do you not speak?
The old man stared with eyes that were so penetrating as to be almost frightening. Wakthago had never seen such intensity in anyone's eyes before. Running Elk was wearing a red shirt trimmed in yellow. Wakthago also noticed that Running Elk's knife, bow, and quiver of arrows, his war club, and his pipe all lay on the ground beside him.
How did you get by me? And why are you wearing your finest clothes and carrying your most prized possessions?
Lakthago was getting uncomfortable now. And the more he tried to cover his embarrassment, the more obvious his embarrassment became.
Are you making a journey?
Yes, I am making a journey.
Where are you going?
Where I go is not important. I've come to tell you of things to come.
You will tell me of things to come? Are you one who can see into the future?
I am a man of knowledge.
You are a man of knowledge, are you? Then tell me of my future.
You have two futures.
Oh. How can one man have two futures?
You have two futures, but can only choose one. One is the future of peace. One is the future of war.
I will not ask you which future I should choose, for I know what you will say. You would have me choose the future of peace.
I cannot choose for you.
Then I choose the future of war.
You choose war so you can have revenge against one white man.
Yes.
You are a brave and ferocious warrior, but you have not chosen wisely. Many of my people will be killed.
I don't care how many are killed, as long as I kill the one called Artur.
Artur will not be killed.
He will be killed, and I will kill him.
I do not have much time. Hear my words so that you know what I speak is true.
I will listen.
The time will come when the one called Artur will visit our village. And while he is here, his tongue will speak without ceasing from sun to sun. The people will not understand his words, but they will feel his power. And the one called Artur will be given a new name.
One cannot be given a new name unless one does a great deed. What great deed will Artur do that he will be given a new name?
He will not do one great deed, but many great deeds. He will live long and become a man of the past and the future. Among the Indians of all nations, songs of Artur's deeds will be sung in councils and around campfires. White men will tell stories of him in places where they gather, and they will write of him in their books. He will be remembered by the grandchildren of the grandchildren of their grandchildren.
And what is this new name to be?
He will be called Preacher.
Preacher. Preacher is what white men call the teachers of their religion. It is not the name of a great warrior.
He will make it the name of a great warrior.
How is it that you know all these things, Running Elk? Do you have the gift of seeing into the future?
I do not see the future. I am the future.
You speak in riddles, old man.
Lakthago turned away from Running Elk and looked back out over the village. The pearl gray of early morning was sharpening in tone and tint, and the teepees took on definition from the bright light of day. He saw three women in mourning dress approaching one of the teepees.
And if I kill Artur, what will happen to the future, you see?
Running Elk didn't answer, but Lakthago didn't repeat the question. He was too interested in what was going on in the village below. He saw that one of the three women was carrying a deer skin. She stopped just outside the teepee, laid the skin down, unrolled it, then took out a red and yellow shirt, a knife, a bow and quiver of arrows, a pipe, and a war club. It wasn't until then that he realized what was going on. The three women were part of a funeral.
Look, someone has died. The women of his family have come to prepare the body.
Lakthago looked more closely at the women.
Wait, I do not understand what I see. Those are the women of your family. Your wife, your daughter, and the wife of your son. Running Elk, what are they doing?
Lakthago turned around to ask his question again, but Running Elk was gone.
Running Elk?
Running Elk was nowhere around. Lakthago wondered where the old engine had gone and how the hell he had gotten away without being seen. Lakthago turned back toward the village and saw that the women had gone into the teepee. Suddenly, he felt a strange tingling sensation, and his body convulsed as if he had a chill.
No, this cannot be.
Quackthago hurried down the side of the hill, running so hard that he thought his heart would burst by the time he got to the teepee. Pushing open the flap, he looked inside. The oldest of the three women looked around at him, and Quackthago saw that her eyes were filled with tears.
What has happened?
My husband has died.
Looking beyond the women, he saw the body of Running Elk lying on a bed of furs.
When did he die?
Last night, after the council.
No, this cannot be.
It is good to see that you are saddened. You spoke against him in council. I am glad he is not your enemy.
Quackthago realized that he would have to accept a fundamental truth. The person who had come to speak with him this morning was not Running Elk, but Running Elk's spirit. Quackthago turned and walked away from the teepee, thinking about the things Running Elk had told him. Quackthago felt privileged to have been visited by Running Elk's spirit, for only those warriors with great medicine were given such visions. But he couldn't tell anyone about it, because Running Elk had come to him to advise the path of peace when he wanted to fight. Suddenly, Quackthago had an idea. He would tell everyone of the visit of Running Elk's spirit. And when they would ask him why Running Elk came to him, he would tell them it was because Running Elk had changed his mind and now wished to say that Blackfoot should make war against the trapper named Artur. Jenny and Carla rode in the wagon bed as old Ben, Jenny's longtime driver, handled the reins and gently slapped the horses forward. They were heading west. Four other girls rode in the second wagon, and they would share the driving duty, following Ben's lead. The only problem was they weren't sure exactly where they were going, other than west. There was precious little in the way of civilization out there beyond St. Louis, and all of them were more than a bit scared at the prospect of leaving behind the place and the people who were so familiar to them. But they sympathized with Jenny's plight and wanted to support her, and they trusted her to take care of them. Jenny knew that she would give every part of herself to make sure that she didn't betray that trust. The truth be told, Jenny was afraid too. She had achieved her dream of living in St. Louis only to have it crushed by the evil that men do. She had seen that evil so many times in the past as men claimed ownership over her. Yet she had risen from slavery to become a successful businesswoman, despite everyone trying to hold her back. She had done it, and she would do it again. Suddenly, a fire ignited deep down inside her. It burned hot and fierce. Jenny couldn't know what lay ahead for her and her companions, but she knew one thing. She would never be a slave again. She would die first. That she was certain. Art's party of trappers rode west along the upper reaches of the wide and wild Missouri. All were alert to the danger that they knew lurked behind every stand of trees and every hill. They kept to the lowest point everywhere they went. And on the third day out from the fort, Art led them onto an old engine trail that looked well trapped. Took him up to a shallow tributary of the Missouri River and into a wide ravine that gave him shelter and hid him from view throughout most of the day's travel. The floor of the ravine was wide. Most of it was a stream bed, nearly 200 yards across, sandy and rocky. Along each side of the river were low bluffs, almost black in color from the dark earth and the shadows where the sun didn't strike them directly. As the ravine opened to the high plain ahead, there was a small island, only about 50 yards long and 30 yards wide. It was dense with willow, alder, and a few tall cottonwoods standing proudly. It took Art's men the remainder of the day to reach the little island. We'll camp there tonight. They all ate a light, cold supper. Art and Hoffman, along with Dog, took the first watch after dark, followed by McDill and Cavanaugh. The youngsters took the final watch, which would last until breakfast time. They kept the horses together in a tight circle at the center of the island, tethered to the strong cottonwood trees. Art had insisted on this, even though McDill had laughed at such seemingly needless precautions. Wakatha Go had formed a party of 12 men, including himself, from the Blackfoot village. He had hoped for more, since he had announced Running Elk's prophecy that the white trappers would be annihilated by the Blackfoot. But he thought he would have more than enough strength, outnumbering the whites 2-1, in a country familiar to the Indians and strange to the trappers. He was dressed in full war costume, wearing buckskin leggings and moccasins elaborately trimmed with beads and feathers, with a single eagle feather fastened in his scalp lock. He wore a white buffalo robe, which was very rare, tanned, and soft, over his otherwise naked torso. And his face was painted in lines of red and black, which gave him a fierce, menacing appearance to anyone who might meet him in battle. The others were similarly dressed. Each warrior carried a rifle or musket, as well as arrows and a hand axe for close-up hand-to-hand fighting and scalping. The war party rode out from the village before dawn, heading southwest to where their scouts had said the white men were camped on an island in the river. As their leader, Wakatha Go rode about 2 horse lengths ahead of his men so they could admire his courage and fierce appearance. The enemy, too, would be cowed by his warrior's painted regalia. He planned to approach the trappers' camp from the east with the rising sun at their backs. It was a simple attack plan that should work easily. Nothing would give him greater satisfaction than wiping out the white trappers and counting coup on their property. They could use the horses and rifles, too. It was going to be a good day for a fight. Art rose before sunup, folded his bedroll neatly, and then began packing his horse. He didn't light a fire. Something told him that they should not this morning. He didn't know why, but he had learned to follow his instincts on such things. Dog was patrolling the island, sniffing and snooping around in the underbrush. He also kept an eye on the horses. He seemed to enjoy making things nervous. Come here, boy. Art tore a piece of jerky in half and tossed it toward Dog. Art chewed on the other half himself. He was hungry, but he had learned to live with hunger as a matter of fact in the wilderness. Dog, too, being half wolf, instinctively knew to eat when it was available because he could not know the next time there might be an opportunity. The other man began to get up to face the new day on the trail. Art watched him. There had been plenty of time for him to form judgments of these men, and there was no question that, other than McDill and Cavanaugh, he liked them. In fact, he respected all of them, even the 2 hostile ones, because their trail sense and ability to adapt to new, sometimes dangerous conditions away from the city were impressive. He only wished there was more of a chance for peace with the Indian tribes. Then all of his party would have better prospects for survival and profit from pelts, as would Mr. Ashley himself. But Art couldn't take on the whole world by himself. He had to have friends and allies to change the ways of the frontier. It was a daunting task, but how could you change men? Well, take McDill, a born bully and a bad man. Still, in a fight, he would be a valuable man to have on your side. The Hessian Hoffman was another case, a good heart and fiercely loyal to his leader. And the others, too, were fighters with whom Art could trust his life, if it ever came to that. Art jumped upright and snatched up his rifle, checking the load.
Everybody up! We got trouble!
From a slow, deliberate awakening, they all leaped to their feet, guns in hand.
What the hell?
We're being attacked! We better be prepared to defend ourselves! They're coming in from over there!
Art pointed across the flat, shallow river. The rising sun lit the black bluff from behind, and skylined atop the ridge, there were several Indians on horseback, brandishing their war spears. They knew better than to stay there. After a minute to show themselves, and they hoped to scare the white men on the island, they rode down to the other side, all but one. That one, a tall man with a single feather on his head and his face painted, remained visible and defiant, as if he were challenging them to take a shot at him. Art was tempted to do just that, but until he knew how many of them there were and where they were coming from, he held off shooting anybody.
McGill and Hoffman, you two take the rear and see if any of them are attacking from the other side of the river. I doubt it, but we just don't know for sure.
Those two turned and went to their position.
Cavanaugh and Montgomery, take the left, over there by those trees. Matthews and I'll take the right. If the engines split up their party to attack from two ways, we'll be covered that way. If I see him coming from one direction, we'll regroup to face him there.
Quickly, the two men rushed off. Art and Matthews turned, moved over to some tall scrub to their right, and hunkered down there, rifles at the ready, powder and shot close at hand for reloading. He had divided up the men to put one quick loader with one slower man. He was the quicker between Matthews and himself. McDill was quicker than the Hessian, and Montgomery was lightning fast on the reload, while Cavanaugh was slow as molasses. Art could only hope for the best, hope that each man and each pair would hold position. The question was, how many engines were about to attack? Men could only wait. Then the attack came. From atop the bluff, the tall engine, who certainly was the leader of the raid, rode straight down the side of the bluff, his horse kicking up black dirt and rocks as he came. To the left, from where Art's men were, a column of attackers came around the bluff, brandishing guns and spears.
McDill, any sign back there?
Nobody, not yet. I don't think they're coming from here.
Art had to make a quick judgment. He had no way of knowing whether the engines had 10 or 100 men in their war party or some number in between. He would have to go with his gut instinct on this. His own men's lives are in his hands now, just like his own.
All right, move up, cover Cavanaugh and Montgomery, but don't bunch up too tight. We gotta present a wide front.
What should we do?
Stay put for a second. I count a total of 12. Now, that's not a lot, but that's twice as many as us. At least that's how many we can see right now. It looks to be Blackfoot.
Yeah, all painted up for war.
Lockdog Gold was proud of these men who had stepped forward to go on this raid. They were the bravest of the brave from among the Blackfoot village where he had found refuge and purpose. He proudly led them into battle this day. When he got to the bottom of the bluff, he wheeled his pony around and went to the head of the column of warriors, then rode with them onto the sandy shoreline of the river. Again, he looked across to take the measure of the men who would die today, his enemy. They didn't look like much. They were armed, though, seemingly ready to meet the attack. Wakthago threw his spear toward the man he thought was the leader of the whites. It missed.
Hold your fire. Don't waste your bullets until you're sure of the shot.
Art watched the tall, fierce warrior who led the party. He lifted his rifle and took aim. The lead warrior was about 10 yards away.
Damn! Missed! Fire!
Art quickly reloaded and primed his weapon and lifted it again. The warriors released their spears, which flew just over the defenders' heads.
Keep shooting!
Art didn't feel panic or fear. He knew what had to be done. He carefully aimed his rifle at another of the engine riders. Too damn. Now the engine leader wheeled his horse to the right and just missed getting shot by Montgomery. The big engine turned and smiled. He pulled his horse to the rear of the attacking party, then turned to charge again. The engines kept coming, and now they had their own rifles and bows at the ready. Arrows plowed into the earth by Cavanaugh, Matthews, and Hawk. McDill frantically reloaded and lifted his gun, just in time for a ball from one of the engines to whiz past his head, missing him by just a few inches. Another man fell. The trappers were cutting down the odds with each passing minute. The Braves circled and fell in behind their leader and charged again. An arrow struck Hoffman in his right arm just below the shoulder. It passed through his flesh and left a bloody pulp. But he barely flinched as he reloaded his rifle, ramming a ball into the barrel. Art saw the blood streaming down the German's arm, but couldn't stop to respond. It was a miracle that Art had not lost a single man yet. He looked around and saw that his men were fiercely concentrated on doing their best to fire, and reload again and again, almost like machines. He was proud of them. There was no time for sympathy. He focused on his own job. With this last volley from the trappers, the engine charge finally broke. Art couldn't help but feel relieved when he saw them turn their horses and flee back into the surrounding forest. Wakthago was unhappy at this turn of events. He had expected to wipe out the whites with a surprise attack, but instead, he had lost three men and the whites none. He signaled to his men to take the three fallen Braves away, back to the far side of the bluff where they had come from in the morning. He cursed the white men who had killed Blackfoot warriors. Secretly, He wondered if he had done something to offend the great spirit of Breath who protected his people. What had he done wrong? The bullets of the whites had cut down three brave Blackfoot. This was not the way it should be. Wakthago led the Braves to a camp about a quarter mile away, in a tree-sheltered area where they could regroup and plan the next attack. One of his men came to Wakthago.
Why have we lost these warriors, my chief? Were we not supposed to kill the evil white ones? Instead, they have killed our men!
This I know, my brother, and I will pray for an answer to your question. I do not know what is in the mind of the spirit who guides and gives life to all his creation.
Wakthago knew that his grandiose promises must be fulfilled. He must wipe out these men on the island, or else he would lose face with the village and with his own men. Hatred and vengeance flared up inside his soul like a roaring campfire. He must go and pray and think about what to do. Wakthago had gone for several hours. At dusk, he returned. Warriors awaited him. They had kept up their watch on the island. The whites were hunkered down in their defensive positions, expecting another attack. But the warriors couldn't move without Wakthago to lead them, so they had stayed in camp and mourned their dead. They all jumped up and greeted him when they saw him riding in.
Tomorrow, we will attack again. The spirit has told me that victory is ours. We will avenge our dead brothers with the scalps of the evil men.